Hi, everyone, and welcome to Televisions, the podcast, an audio companion to the Televisions website and a show made by Anglophiles for Anglophiles. I'm Lacey Bogger Milas. I am still not used to saying that. Maybe sometime in 2021 I'll get used to it, but I am still the editor here at Televisions, and joining me as always is my co-host and partner in crime, Miss Sandy Bundle.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you today?
This is it. I feel like I should warn our listeners in advance that if I sound a little weird, I don't think I will, but I might, or if like suddenly, I don't know. The cats found my microphone this week and I try to hide it from them, but Baker, Lou, and Hammersmith don't care about what I want them to get into or not want them to get into. And they maybe did a little damage to my mic. So this is just another example for all of you listening at home of the glamorous life of professional podcasting. I think my mic's okay. Baker and Hammer, say hi.
All right. I think we'll be fine. You sound fine to me anyway.
Okay. I just want the people to know, just in case. Mostly I just want to talk about my cats and blame them for being small jerks.
So what are we talking about today?
We are continuing our Drunk with Power look at things that are not necessarily like public media related, because we're in a bit of a dry spell there. But there's plenty of TV on elsewhere. So we are going to talk about one of the shows that you cover for us, and I think is one of your faves. I actually really liked the second season of this, which is currently happening right now, and that is the HBO fantasy drama His Dark Materials, which is based on a book by a British dude.
It's also produced by BBC One.
Right. I always forget that. For some reason, whenever HBO brings over these shows, like I always mentally stick the HBO first, even though I know that's not... Like, they are Gentleman Jack, too, and that's also a BBC show. And yeah. I'm like, oh, it's an HBO show. The power of their brand is what I'm saying.
It's true. But actually, this is a BBC One show, and in terms of first season actually aired over in the UK before it came over here. In this case, I believe we're getting them at the same time due to,
I think it might air in the UK on Sundays and it's here on Mondays, maybe. It's within 24 hours, so.
And that's actually pretty different from, you know, most other things that HBO has partnered with like Game of Thrones, say. Game of Thrones aired over here on Sunday and then aired in the UK on Monday. And in this case, because this is a BBC show first, they get it on Sunday and we get it on Monday. But this is based on a trilogy of novels by Philip Pullman released in the late 1990s.
I looked it up. The first novel, The Northern Lights, which most Americans probably know as The Golden Compass, was published in 1995.
Yeah. Thank you,
Wikipedia, for that knowledge.
To sort of explain like how these books were very popular when they came out.
I remember reading them like years ago.
Yeah.
And I always thought that this was something. I'm actually really impressed that they've managed to make this show out of it, because it's such a big sprawling thing that it's hard to, I think, adapt for the screen.
Yeah. It comes from basically this sort of a generation of books that was sort of, if you think of science fiction and fantasy as sort of dividing itself into like, you know, sections of like, you know, one age, two age, like the early ages, like, you know, Jules Verne and Edgar Rice Burroughs, excuse me. And the second age is like, you know, Lord of the Rings and Dune. This is sort of a third age where these big sprawling epics became really like the thing to write. Like this Game of Thrones, which is a Song of Ice and Fire novels, came out literally in 1996, like less than a year after The Northern Lights. And then, you know, Harry Potter came out in 97. These were sort of the big three of that period, of this sort of, you know, third age of fantasy sci-fi books.
You sound like J.R.R. Tolkien.
I don't mean it like that, but you know what I'm saying? Like you can sort of divide like literature into periods. This is sort of like, you know, these three basically all came out within like 18 months, 2 years of each other, and were sort of viewed in a way as sort of at least in the UK as sort of like being within the same sort of vein. Like the Philip Pullman books were really, really popular in the UK. And like, I believe in there was a poll that was done on the BBC like a few years after the turn of the century, and like The Amber Spyglass, which is the last of the three books, was named like one of the best fantasy books of the 20th century. You know, and so they sort of always saw themselves, the people who sort of own this IP franchise, as being on par with Harry Potter and with A Song of Ice and Fire, Game of Thrones.
Although I think it is important to put out that the target audiences for all three of those series are quite different.
Oh, yes, they are. And that's actually part of the problem, is that, like, so Harry Potter, you know, immediately went and made all of these movies, and they started out as children's movies because, you know, for all that Harry Potter nowadays is sort of problematic and we won't talk about Rowling, one of the genius things about those books is that they are coming of age books written for a reader to come of age along with them. So starting as a children's movie and building into more young adult movies works because that's how the books are written. And with when His Dark Materials sort of attempted to chase that, to make movies of their own, they also started with making these into a children's movie about Lyra and her talking animal friends. And that was very unfortunate because the books are actually very, very complex.
They're very dense.
They are not children's books at all. And it was really unfortunate because, you know, they had a great cast. It was Daniel Craig as Lord Asriel and Nicole Kidman as Mrs. Coulter and Dakota Blue Richards, who we just saw in Beecham House, as Lyra. This is a great cast and totally wasted. The movie's horrible. Like, it was so bad that they didn't get a sequel. And seriously, Percy Jackson got a sequel, okay? Like, you don't have
it's
to be
truly,
that.
It's truly, like, on the merits, it's a bad film. Not just even that it's a bad adaptation of this novel and a bad version of this world. Like, it's just a bad movie.
Yeah.
It's really, like, it was so disappointing because I wanted it to be good and it is not good.
And the problem is that you can't make this into a children's movie.
To be honest, like, the fact that they tried to make the first couple of Harry Potter books into like very distinctly kids movies is why the first two Harry Potter movies are so bad.
Yeah.
Chamber of Secrets is garbage. I said it. It's horrible. Like, if we could just take every copy of that film and throw it in the garbage, I'd be fine.
I mean, this is a book that, like, the His Dark Materials is actually taken from John Milton's Paradise Lost, as is that whole renaming it the Golden Compass for American audiences is actually also pulled from Paradise Lost. And that's because there's a lot of that sort of, there are a lot of those motifs from the Milton book that translate into this science fiction fantasy.
It's a poem. I'm sorry. I wrote so many graduate papers on Paradise Lost. Get ready for my nerdery on that score.
I'm sorry. I think of it as a book because that's how it was handed to me. But you are correct. It is a poem.
It's not a book.
But anyway, the point is that, like, this is a story, the His Dark Materials, that's, even though it stars a pair of children in Lyra and Will, and their prepubescent nature is actually, like, fundamental to the plot, this is really a story about, you know, basically, like, finding your true north finding secular truth as your true north, and believing the science, and, you know, not taking things on faith. And the bad guys in this story are basically, I mean, they're not the Catholic Church, and the show has made, you know, a lot of noise about, we don't mean this to be the Catholic Church, except that, you know, it looks just like the Catholic Church, it walks just like the Catholic Church, it talks just like the Catholic Church. And it is basically because when the Catholic Church was at its height of power, that's what happens. Absolute power turns you into that. And so the magisterium, which is what they call it in the novels, follows that path because that's the natural path for, you know, a theocracy to take.
As the podcast resident Catholic, I have some thoughts about this. But,
I'm sure.
We'll just. I'm just going to voice my disapproval of that and we'll move on.
Okay. I don't mean to insult the Catholic Church. I'm just saying that, like, this, it doesn't surprise me that it looks like the Catholic Church, because that's when the Catholic Church was at its height of power. That's what religious power kind of takes the shape of. And so, of course, when writing a book about a, you know, a religious power, it's going to take that shape because that's what we know. Anyway, I'm getting off topic. The point is that, like, Lyra and Will are basically these two children from two different multiverses, and they basically accidentally find each other. And there's a prophecy about what the two of them will do, though neither of them actually know about the prophecy, and that is deliberate, because if they know about the prophecy, they can't. They have to know, they have to do what they're supposed to do without knowing that they're doing it, kind of thing. And the structure of the books is really difficult also to adapt, because the first book is nothing but Lyra's world in this, you know, in this alternate Earth where it's run as a theocracy, and like everybody's under the thumb of this one great power, and they have sort of suppressed science, and they have suppressed, you know, discovery, and they, you know, sort of a fascist state that's sort of risen up and been in charge for many, many generations, and to the point where no one questions it. And part of the reason why this theocracy was able to sort of rise is because this version of Earth has one major difference from our world, and that's that your soul lives on the outside of your body.
And it's a cute animal.
And there's no question of whether or not. This is a world where people don't ask questions of, do we have a human soul? Because the human soul is right there. In fact, you can ask it, hey, are you the human soul? Well, kind of, you know, and they're cute. And when they're small, when you're a kid, your soul can take like whatever shape or form it wants. It can go from a bird to a fish to a cute red panda to, you know, whatever, to a ferret, to a dog, cat, etc. But when you hit puberty, your soul sort of settles, and that whatever form it takes is sort of you as your animal spirit, I guess. Because of that, you know, religion has sort of taken over, because, you know, it's almost like you don't have to have faith because it's right there in front of you. Anyway, the point is that, like, so Lord Asriel, who is the father of Lyra, has been doing scientific experiments, you know, in secret. And he has discovered basically that there is a weakness up in the Northern Lights where you can maybe cross from one world to another. And
it's like the hole in the ozone layer, but for dimensions.
And that's a good way of thinking of it. And he has traveled to the north, and Lyra follows him, not realizing what it is her father is trying to do. She's just basically following her father because she wants to know where he is, and she wants to help him, and she loves
him. He's not like a Hall of Fame dad. So I think this is sort of, you know, a lot of it is about Lyra's really complicated relationship with him and how she wants to be sort of validated and seen by her father in a way that she really doesn't get the chance to be. And, you know, as most kids, she's like, if I go do this thing he's told me not to do, he'll definitely respect me as an adult.
I think it's actually very interesting that both she and Will are sort of spiritual orphans in this way. Like, in most of these books, you know, the main character either is an orphan or becomes an orphan. You know, think like Arya and Sansa Stark, or, you know, Harry Potter. Harry Potter is an orphan from the beginning. The Starks become orphans very quickly. Lyra and Will's parents are all alive, and yet Lyra's parents have basically abandoned her because they are more interested in, they have this sort of narcissistic genius, you know, they are too interested in themselves to care about their child, and too interested in discovery to care about their child. Mrs. Coulter is, you know, a monster, basically, of a mother when Lyra comes to live with her, there's literally a scene which is their version of abuse where Mrs. Coulter sicks her demon, the golden monkey, and has it beat the crap out of Lyra's demon, which is basically their version of, you know, physical abuse. In Will's world, like, his father has literally left him and crossed over. He's actually gone a step further. Lord Asriel is trying to leave and cross over, and Will's father has actually done it. And, like, he's left his wife and kid and, like, is off doing his own scientific discovery. And Will's mother has completely fallen apart, so she's not really a parent either. She's more of someone he has to take care of than someone who takes care of him. And I think I find that really interesting, since so many of these, like, you know, you have the characters are orphans because, you know, their parents need to be gotten out of the way. And in this case, we get the parents out of the way, even though they're not dead.
I think it's interesting because so often in stories like this, like it's the sort of Bambi of it all, you know, like we have to kill the parent in order for the child's story to start. But I mean, like, people have parents that suck. And that's not uncommon, unfortunately. So, I mean, I don't know. Well, I guess it begs the question of, like, is it worse for your parents to be sort of like fridged off screen to drive your emotional development, or to just be terrible and always be the thing that you're kind of chasing after but will never attain? Because even as Lara discovers, like, even when you catch them, like, even when you find the thing you've been searching for, like, it's not what you wanted. It's broken.
They're still terrible. They don't magically become great parents just because you're like, hi, I'm here now. Like, that's not how life works. And I actually, it's one of the things I really like about the books, is that it sort of follows that idea. But the thing is that the first movie flopped and it sort of languished, and it was sort of like there wouldn't be a new adaptation. And then Game of Thrones came along and sort of created this world where we now, you know, make books into 8 to 10 hour television shows in order to adapt them properly so that they don't, you know, so you don't have to condense them into a 2.5 hour movie. So then when the rights reverted back to Pullman and his people, they made a deal with the BBC to do this, you know, to do it as a series. And it took a long time, you know, I think the rights reverted in like 2015, and it took until 2019 to get the show on the air. And by then, like, Game of Thrones was basically over, and the world had sort of moved on from this very dry sort of adaptation of, you know, chapter to screen in a very simplified way. Like, it wasn't just that it was, you know, at that point, like, just sort of it was almost stale. So season one was really sort of difficult because, like, they were basically doing what was the big thing in 2010, 10 years later, and it sort of felt like, well, this would have been great if this was 2010 when this came out, but now it's sort of, I don't know, sort of a has-been, has-done. And it felt really dry.
I don't think that's why the first season felt dry. I agree with you that the first season of this show is not... The first season of this show is fine. Like, it's actually a fairly faithful adaptation of the book that it's based on. It really does spend a lot of time in world building, and it spent a lot of money on these, like, amazing sets. But the thing that it doesn't do, I was going to say very well, but I actually think I mean not at all, is it does not capture, like I said, I've read these books years ago and I loved them. And there's just such a sense of, like, wondrous otherness to the Golden Compass and to this world that Lyra inhabits that the show does not capture at all. And part of that, I think, is because, and I suspect this is actually because of money, because it costs a lot to CGI these talking animals, but this show gets demons completely wrong. Like, it does not have any of the, basically, like, in the first season of this show, they're just, like, talking animal friends.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't get any of, like, the wonder of this bond. The bond between Lyra and Pan is, like, non-existent. There's none of the magic and wonder feeling of this universe that we should be experiencing, like, looking through, even though, like, Lyra's our POV character and this is normal for her, so we're not going to get, like, that sense of from her, because it's like this is all she knows. Like, there are still ways I think that the show could and should have shown us that as viewers, instead of doing what it did, which is sort of very matter-of-factly delineate that this is a demon and this is the magisterium and this is whatever, and it's very, like, book report, and it does not get any of, like, the spirit of the show in the first season. I think the show goes a long way to course correct that in the second season, which I personally think is an order of magnitude better than the first one. But I think a lot of people probably, unfortunately, like, walked away from it in the first season because it was so book report.
It is very book report, and that's partly because of the structure of the book. The first book is totally from Lyra's point of view, and going from Lyra's point of view sort of hides many of the things that are surprises towards the end, like the fact that there are multiverses, like the fact that,
But I think there's enough of. I read a lot of fantasy, and I read a lot of like alternate universe fiction. And I feel like there's enough in the ways that we can see how her world is similar to and dissimilar to our world that should power, the story shouldn't have to spell that out for us, because we should be able to see it and feel it in everything that's happening. And the first season just does not do that.
Yeah. And part of the problem also is that, like, in the first season, the big thing that Lyra discovers is that her mother's secret scientific experiments is taking children and literally cutting their demons away. And this should be horrifying. This should be the worst thing that anyone could possibly do to someone.
But they don't lean enough into the demon relationship and to the like magic of these creatures for it really to like hit you the way that it should. That is no fault of Ruth Wilson, who is honestly the only reason to watch the first season. She's incredible. Her character is incredible. And actually, I will go out on a limb and say that the book's read on Mrs. Coulter is much less interesting than the one presented in the show.
I would absolutely agree with that, yes.
I think Mrs. Coulter is the only part of certainly the first season, for sure, and I think for the show as a whole, I think Mrs. Coulter is the one part that the TV show does tremendously better than the books.
I would absolutely agree with that, and that's partly because, you know, men writing women is never quite as well-rounded as when women write ourselves. And part of the problem, I think, with the books is that, you know, they suffer from, this is a thing from a lot of 90s books where men write women's point of views, is that it's never quite right. And this is a thing that I believe about a lot of books that come out in that time, like Wheel of Time is another one. Game of Thrones, if you read the Song of Ice and Fire, is like Sansa is much better on the screen than she is on the page.
I love her in both places, but I know Sansa. I am ride or die for Sansa Stark. So.
But I think that that's part of it, is that like having a more well-rounded version of Mrs. Coulter on TV is one of the show's strengths. But one of the things that struck me the most is that when Lyra gets up to the place where they're doing these terrible experiments, it's being run by nurses who are very quiet and obedient, and it's because their demons have been cut away from them, and she's horrified by this. And we have an entire episode where you don't even notice that until it is pointed out to you in the next episode, that you should notice immediately that these people don't have demons, and you don't, and it's because the show hadn't emphasized it enough.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that, and I also think, again, I think it comes back to budget and money, because to be fair, in every scene that has a person in it, it should be like swarming with demons.
Right.
And it's not, even in scenes where like it's normal, like it is not like people aren't having their souls physically like cleaved from their bodies. The show doesn't have the budget or interest, I think, in handling that part of things. Like even in regular scenes between people, I remember at the end of the first season when Mrs. Coulter and Lord Asriel come together again, I remember the thing that has stuck with me the longest is the way that their demons interact during that scene. And that should be happening in every scene everywhere. And it's not.
Yeah.
Because that's how you tell, or in my mind, that's how you should tell, like when someone is lying or when someone is being performative, like what they say and what their demon is doing are like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not expressing this well, but like the fact that like the stuff that she's saying in that scene versus what her monkey and Stelmaria, is that Asriel's demon? I think so. The pretty snow leopard are interacting. Like, it's very, also voiced by my girl, Helen McCrory, just to point that out. Like, they have this amazing voice cast that plays all these CGI animals, and they don't do anything with them.
It's true. Like, one of the things, a moment that struck me is, so one of the more problematic aspects of the book that hasn't aged well is are the nomads, who are sort of the one group of people who really aren't under the thumb of the Magisterium. In the books, they're called Gyptians, which is, you know, and they are definitely modeled on the Romani. we meet them as they're having basically a huge party, and there's a huge group of them, and you see like maybe five or six demons altogether, and it should be, as you said, swarming with them in this kind of humongous group setting. You should be able to see all of them. It should feel as much like a zoo as it does a group of people, and it doesn't. And again, that is probably budget, but
it is the one thing I think the show really gets wrong, and it's the one thing I think it doesn't course correct in season two. I think season two does a lot of things right. I wish season one had been as good as season two is, because I think the show would fare better for it. But like the demon thing is still...
it's still an issue.
In season two, Pan really is just a talking animal friend, which makes at least a little more sense, because they're in these different worlds where people don't have demons. So it's not as much as like, why don't all these other people have these talking animal friends? But like that, it's a problem still.
I would also say that some of the magic that comes with season two. So in book one, Will does not happen. We literally only live with Lyra. In book two, we have this huge section of just Will as we're introduced to his character. And then I think it may be like about a third or almost halfway through, the two of them finally come together. One of the things that season one did right was to seed in Will in the first season and see him by himself on Earth as a comparison to Lyra's world, so that we sort of got this sense of, and that helped a little bit with the magic, but
so,
not.
Yeah. So we sort of knew there was another place that looked more familiar to us.
Yeah. And so that means that in season two, we could immediately start with the two of them meeting up with each other, and we can get sort of Will's amazement at demons. At the same time, they're not going to Lyra's world very much, so like he doesn't get the full effect of it, and so we still don't get the magic of that, because we haven't gotten a character who really is amazed by this. They're in this in-between world, Sigazi, where another world where there aren't demons, so Lyra is basically the only one with a talking animal friend, as you know. And the thing is that I really like the two of them together. I think it works really well, but again, we haven't been given the sense of how personal a demon is and how that relationship is. Like Lyra says to him, you're not supposed to touch my demon, but it's okay because my demon touched you. And so we sort of lose that again. And I mentioned this earlier when we talk about like when Mrs. Coulter has her monkey pounce on Lyra's demon to punish her, like, that should be much more shocking than it is when we see it. And it's not. I think season two gets a little bit more of that right when we have the reverse, when Lyra's demon Pan attacks the golden monkey. We get a little bit more of the horror of what that's supposed to be and how terrible it is to do that to somebody. But again, it's more like the two talking animals are fighting. Well, the golden monkey doesn't talk, but it's very frustrating, because like I think that is my biggest frustration with the show, is that I don't know how that could ever be. I don't know if this is if we still weren't at the right point to make this show, is what I'm thinking, is that like maybe this is a show that really couldn't be properly made until CGI reached such a point that it was, you know, I don't know, pennies.
Yeah, I don't know, because I agree with you, that is the part that still to me feels the weirdest, because the demon feel like pets as often as they feel like an extension of the person that they hang out with, and that is I know it's not my show, not my circus, not my monkeys, but I'm like, it's wrong. That's wrong.
The thing is though, by leaving Lyra's world mostly behind in season two, the show has very much like improved, leaving as much as
truly I think season two is great. Season two is it has the very like. And I think season two is good because it sort of really embraces that like sense of adventure and sense of like this is moving towards something that season one lacks in places.
And it's also that it goes more off book. Like we are not, this is not a book report in the same sort of way. And part of that is that we've now built up some of the changes that, you know, every small change that happens in season one makes a much larger change in season two, the butterfly effect type thing. But like, so for instance, like Lord Boreal is a very tiny character in the novels. Like he's not a big deal.
Oh yeah, that is actually, I think, one of the best things other than Mrs. Coulter, which is
the guy they cast for Ariane Bakari is actually he's a comedian, but like he was known mostly just as a comedian. He didn't really do dramatic roles, and they totally cast him on a lark, and he is literally one of the best things about the show. They started building up his character in season one by adding him into Will's world, and he has a much larger role this season, and I feel like that really helps him and Ruth Wilson together. In the latest episode of
relationship is really interesting and great.
This is okay. So for those who don't know, this was supposed to be an 8-episode season, and because of the pandemic, the final episode, which would be Lord Asriel, got basically didn't get filmed in time before things shut down. So we're only getting 7 episodes. So episode 5, which aired on Monday, is the third to last episode. So we have 2 more to go. And basically, like the putting those two together has been such a smart thing. Also, putting her, when they had Ruth Wilson meet Lin-Manuel Miranda as Lee Scoresby, that also to me was a brilliant moment.
Oh yeah.
So Lee Scoresby in the books is basically an American stereotype. Like, it's very much a character that we in American books do not get, because we as American books don't stereotype ourselves like that. Like, it's very much a British person's idea of what a Texan should be. And so it's a hard...
Which is so funny that they cast Lin-Manuel Miranda to do it. Like, he's clearly having a blast. But I also am like, really? I don't know that I thought that he was the right choice.
In season one, he felt very miscast. And it's not like I need like a Sam Elliott, like white dude, grizzled, gray haired type to play this role. But even so, the concept of Lee Scoresby as this Texan, I liked the idea of Lin-Manuel Miranda, but as an actor, I didn't feel like he fit that part. I felt like they were trying to sort of squeeze him into it, and he was sort of trying to squeeze himself into it, and it never quite worked until he met Ruth Wilson this season. Yeah. That was the moment when I suddenly saw his version of Lee Scoresby, and I saw why they cast him, and the two of them playing against each other was literally some of the best TV I'd watched that week. Like, it was so good. And it's one of those things where this is not really a thing from the books either. But they put these two characters together, and they made this incredible moment. And they needed it. I feel like season one could have done with a lot more of that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like season two is improving because we get a lot more of that.
I 100% agree. And I think it's not an accident that all of the best stuff in the show happens when Ruth Wilson is around.
And then it's stuff that would not have happened in the books. Like, the again, in this last episode with her meeting Mary Malone. And meeting a woman in this different world from hers, who does have a doctorate and who is free and who is impertinent and who doesn't give a damn what men think and is off doing her research and doesn't even know that this is like a thing that is so valuable to her.
I loved all of that. That scene with the two of them together, where like you could sort of see Mrs. Coulter
cracking,
evaluating the life that she could have had in a different world is just like it's gut punch good. Like, I know she's supposed to be the villain of the story, but for me in the show, she's actually one of its most like sympathetic aspects because she is so exceptional and she is stuck in this world that will never acknowledge how exceptional she is and will always try to make her second. So, I mean, yeah, she does some terrible stuff, but I also feel like, I don't know, I just love this take on her character.
And I think it's really interesting that Boreal is like, she'll like it in this world, but he doesn't understand why.
Yeah.
And that it's not even a thing he can comprehend why. And that she can see that he is giving her an invitation to come into this world and live this life, and that he has no idea what he's actually even offering by offering that. Again, everything about the two of them is great. Everything Ruth Wilson does in this show is great. And really, she really is the reason to watch this show.
She truly is.
Though I will say that Daphne Keene, who plays Lyra, and the kid who plays Will, whose name just Amir Wilson, thank you. Totally fell out of, like, yeah. The two of them are really great together. I don't think they're so good alone, but when they're playing off each other, they have such great chemistry that it really sort of makes the whole kids on a mission cliche take off.
You're right. Their relation, they're really good together. Mm-hmm. And I think this story doesn't work if you don't really believe in Will and Lyra as a unit. Mm-hmm. And I think this does get that right. Like, I don't know. I feel like the show, and I say this, it's like, again, I think that the second season is an order of magnitude better than the first one.
But
I
it
think,
still like, has problems. Like, okay, so they don't really know what to do with the Magisterium now that Lyra has left the world, and now that Mrs. Coulter has left the world.
Also the witches. I don't know what they're trying to do with the witches.
I don't understand. At this point, like, they're trying to make the Magisterium into sort of a fascist parable of the fascism rising, which, again, because in the 90s, you know, we weren't in this sort of world where fascism could re-rise. You know, fascism was a thing we defeated back in World War II, thank you very much, and wasn't coming back. And that's how this book was sort of viewed it. Like, so fascism was a thing that was established a long time ago, and it's not leaving, thank you very much. And the show is trying to update that to sort of get with the times, and we sort of got these scenes with the Magisterium being all like, but at the same time, like, I don't know. It was I feel really bad about this because the guy who plays Father MacPhail, who is now the cardinal, is Will Keane, and he's actually Daphne Keane's dad. And I feel
really bad.
I don't like his character. I don't think he's very good.
It's kind of just like, well, we get it. We know they're oppressive and bad. So I don't think they're very good about. And you know what else I don't think they're very good about is the prophecy business. Like, they try to make that be like a big thing, but it doesn't. It's
also because they can't really talk about the prophecy because Lyra can't know about the prophecy. Mm. So it's sort of a thing everybody references without actually telling us what the heck the prophecy is. So it's just sort of this nebulous thing that the witches are all concerned about. And the witches are just, I do not get what the heck.
I don't either. I want to love the witches, like, because I think they're so cool. Like, I think the way the show has sort of rendered them is really interesting. I think the visuals surrounding them are awesome. I love, like, that they all have these hawk demons and I love the sort of because they do whatever it is that they do that allows their demons to be like very far away from them. I don't remember what they call
they pass through clouds that somehow allow the bond to sort of stretch.
Magic, it's fine.
And it is hinted that Mrs. Coulter has also done that. In her scientific experiment, she went through that, or she experimented with it, which is why she can leave her monkey behind in a way that, like, no one else really can, which is very useful.
But that scene where and I am so sorry, I never remember any of the witch's names except Sophia Pecola or whatever her name is.
Serafina Pecola.
Sorry. She's the only one whose name I even remotely ever remember.
The other one, the one that kills the old cardinal, is Ruta.
Oh, well, because I was going to say that whole sequence where she goes through just killing all those dudes. That was awesome. Like, that was so visually, like, interesting and cool looking. And it just, like, went nowhere.
Yeah, that's the other thing. So basically we have this thing where Serafina Pecola is like, don't go around killing the cardinals. We don't care about the Magisterium. They can do whatever they like. We are only caring about Lyra. And Ruta's like, no, dude, I'm going to go kill the cardinal. And Ruta goes and kills the cardinal. And then Ruta's like, they're bombing us. What happened? Well, you went and killed the cardinal? Of course they wouldn't bomb you. Like, that's the first thing. And then, like, Serafina Pecola is like, well, we don't care about any of that. Yes, our lands have been bombed. It's terrible. But we have to go follow Lyra. And so what do? They then take revenge for the bombing of their lands and murder all these people on the way out the door. The whole motivations behind this just, like...
I know this isn't something that they really could have left out of the show, mm-hmm. but I kind of wish they'd left it out of the show. Mm-hmm. Like, I wish they'd figured out a way to, like, tell this story without this stuff happening. I mean, Serafina Pecola is actually a pretty important character, but like, the rest of this is just, it feels like it's happening on another show. I feel like I would like that show because, like I said, I really, like, I find the witches fascinating and also completely separate from the rest of everything that's happening.
I felt a lot during season one that basically there was one show that was happening with all of the actors and then another with Bruce Wilson, and that everybody else really needed to get on Ruth Wilson's show because it was just not working with it. Was the one I, it, was, were a, on it was not a, working.
Ruth Wilson's show was a much better show.
And this season, I feel like a lot of the characters have gotten on par with Ruth Wilson's show. The Magisterium has not. But Lyra and Will have. Will's entire world has. By the way, I love Simone Kirby as Mary Malone. Like, I think she's brilliant.
Yeah.
Like, we actually haven't had a lot of Andrew Scott at this point.
I was saving that to be like, well, mostly I was going to be shallow and be like, Andrew Scott looks so hot in this show, which he does.
That top knot.
I guess dirty Indiana Jones works for him, but like I love him in this part, and I love that he's part of the show, and I just am sort of really mad that he's only now kind of entered the field, if you will, and there's like two episodes left.
I will note the thing about Andrew Scott, the thing about John Perry that I feel like this show is getting right that the books didn't even get right is how much like Lord Asriel he really is.
Mm-hmm.
and really underlying how Will and Lyra's parents are basically the same in this way.
I mean, I think he's maybe slightly less of a d- but
no,
I don't know. I mean, he's not like murdering children, so that's good.
No, he's not murdering children, but he is perfectly happy to have left his family behind and live a completely other life, because why should he get back? Because he's having a lot of fun exploring things here.
Oh, yeah, but that's just being like a terrible father.
Yeah.
He's not literally like murdering kids, so it's true. Willing to put him on a slightly lower rung than Lord Asriel, which I feel like we should mention. The reason he doesn't appear in this season is that he doesn't appear in this book.
Yes.
And you don't find out anything else about him until the third novel.
And the eighth episode that they made that sort of was the, here's what Lord Asriel's been doing this whole time, was
that was the one they were going to make, yeah?
Yeah. And that was supposed to be also because, I mean, seriously, they cast James McAvoy, who is literally the biggest, to us, Ruth Wilson is the biggest name in this show because we are PBS people. But to the rest of the world, James McAvoy, who has been in like, you know, half a dozen superhero A-list films, is the big name. And you can't have a season without the biggest name in your cast. So they had made this entire, they had basically written this entire eighth episode to sort of have a way to put James McAvoy in the season, and then they didn't even get to film it.
Womp. Which again, I want more of him simply because I want more of his demon. I mean, like, really? Tell McCrory.
I would also be very interested, because they now sort of have this floating episode that will eventually get filmed and will probably come out before season three. I'm sort of curious how they'll handle it, if they'll sort of make it a I don't know, a holiday special, or if they'll just sort of release it as a His Dark Materials special episode. I'm really curious. Or if they'll just sort of smash it onto the front of season three.
I don't know. I guess the answer to that question will really be like how long is the production for season three?
Yeah. I mean, that everything's been delayed at this point because of, you know, the world. But a lot of things, a lot of TV shows and a lot of films are slated to start filming in January or a little bit later. And there seems to be a sort of a feeling now that we are really going to get back on track before, you know, 2021 is going to be a little hairy, but we actually are going to kind of get back on track towards the end of the year.
Fingers crossed. I mean, we're really lucky we got the second season at all, which mm-hmm. shows that someone was paying attention about how hard it is to film with kids. Because they grow up so fast.
Yeah, actually, and that's partly because, and honestly, we were also lucky about this because, you know, season one was so flat. But season two was greenlit before season one even debuted, like on either side of the pond. And that's partly because they didn't want Keen or Wilson to grow up. And so they needed to start filming right away. So that's partly why there was no chance to cancel it, even if season one didn't fly so well, because season two was already on the books. And so you might as well make season three too. And, you know, they actually were filming season two while season one was airing, which is why they got so many episodes done before the pandemic shut down. Otherwise, they wouldn't have finished.
That's true. I mean, thank goodness for kids growing quickly, which makes me a little nervous that, like, we're going to suddenly come back and, like, like Lyra and Will be like old enough to drive cars.
It's not going to be as bad as poor Stranger Things.
Oh yeah.
There are shows that are much more screwed than this one. I think at this point, and also I think like both Daphne Keene and Will, they don't look like the kinds of where they are in their development. They don't look like they're suddenly going to grow a foot. Like they're probably pretty close to where they're going to be. So it's not like they're suddenly going to get hit by the puberty stick. At this point, I feel like season two is sort of hiding the fact that they've sort of already been swatted with it. Especially Keene, who is supposed to be so young. Who's acting really season two. Also, that's the other thing about this season that I really like is how young I could feel Lyra was once she was taken out of her element and how completely immature she was in comparison to Will. And that's something that I felt like season one really didn't come across properly.
I do think they did a much better job in season two and maybe it was because it was Lyra in a fish out of water scenario of being like, oh my God, why is she doing this dumb crap? When she like gets in the car with Boreal, when she like, when she goes back to see the scholar the second time, even though she knows she shouldn't. And like, there's so much like of her being a kid in this that I think, we don't see as much in season one, which
again, it's because we're seeing it through her eyes and this is just the way the world is. So of course she can just run through the kitchens, you know, or of course she can just jump on a gypsum boat. Like she can just do these things and everybody's okay with it. And like, she doesn't think about why she's allowed to do these things or why everybody's so permissive with mm-hmm. her. Yeah.
Well, there's what are we on right now? There are two episodes left.
There are two episodes left, and then we will have a floating eighth episode that will appear at some point. And then season three was already greenlit, and hopefully we'll start filming next year.
Fingers crossed. I am grateful that at least we should probably get like a full version of the story, because they do seem to be sticking to like one book per season, though I think it might really behoove them to break the third one into three and four, but I don't make the rules. So at least we will get some full version of Pullman's story on screen, for better or worse.
And the other thing about like this series is that it also inspired him to sort of return to this world, and we are now getting
Have you read The Book of Dust? I haven't read it.
Yes, I have. I actually really liked it, and I've asked for the new one for Hanukkah, so hopefully I'll be getting that soon and I can read that. But I feel like letting one of the things about His Dark Materials in comparison to both Potter and Game of Thrones is that they went on to be like seven or eight books, or with Game of Thrones sort of stalled out after five. Whereas this was very...
We're never getting the end of that series ever.
Nope. But Pullman really did stick to this trilogy and really didn't want to give us more until he was inspired to do so. And I really respect that. And I think I wish more fantasy would hold true to, no, the story has an end.
Yeah, exactly. Because I also think that even if you never read The Book of Dust and whatever the sequel to The Book of Dust is called, like if you
Serpentine.
Only read the three books, the three original books, the story is full and complete and you will be completely satisfied with it. And if you want to read more in this universe, you can. But if you feel like, great, this is done and I'm moving on to other things, you can also do that. And it's fine. Yay. Yeah, I think we may have run a little bit long, but that's okay because it's the end of the year and there are no rules. So,
no rules,
right? Thanks for listening with us through this extended episode, folks. Annie, tell the people where they can find you on the interwebs.
You can find me at Annie Bundle on Twitter. You can find me at Miss Annie Bundle on Facebook. You can find pictures of my ever-growing cats at Annie Bundle on Instagram. This week Max discovered that he's getting too big to get out from under the couch, and he's very upset about it. So,
mine are headed for that soon.
Yeah, he had to pull himself out by his side when he went under last time, and he's been looking very, very madly at the couch, like they can't get under there anymore.
Yeah, mine have a bad habit of kicking their toys under the TV, and they used to just be able to go under there and get them, and now they got to work a lot harder to get under there to get them, and I don't think I don't think my little live Swiffers will be functional under the television for much longer.
Let's see. I am a staff writer at Elite Daily. I write for television.org. You may have heard of it. And I also freelance around the web. So you can check me out. Basically, follow me on Twitter, and that's where I retweet all my bylines anyway, and that's, you know, the best way to find everything I've written.
I already follow her. You can follow me on Twitter if you would like at LacyMB, LacyMB, where I also post all of my bylines from the other places I write around the entertainment web. I write a lot here at Televisions as well. And I share a lot of cat pictures. So, you know, come check that out. If you just want the cats and none of my writing, you can follow the boys at Baker and Hammer on Instagram. Televisions is brought to you by WETA. And if you like what we do, you can visit televisions.org and click on the donate button up top to help us keep doing it and support public media at the same time. You can also, and I forgot to say this before, follow the site and the pod on social media. We're at tele_visions on Twitter and televisions blog, all one word, on Facebook. Things are getting scary out there, folks. I know that the state in which I currently reside is upping their restrictions on what you are and are not allowed to do currently. So check the news. Make sure you're staying safe. Make sure you're in compliance with regulations. Please wear a mask. I just noticed my Apple Watch will time how long I wash my hands for, which is useful and also extremely creepy. But hey, means I'm washing my hands. So that's good. Everyone else should do it too. Thank you, as always, for listening. We have one more episode headed your way in 2020 before we take a little break to, I don't know, watch some more TV probably. So keep an eye out for that. And thanks, as always, for listening with us.